as we continue this shift to massive centralization, concentration, dependency in core areas across all things. We've got to have mitigation strategies. We've got to be wide-eyed. We've got to educate our stakeholders as to the fact that potential risks can occur. And sometimes we only learn through the feeling of pain what the risk was, and then we respond to that pain, either observing it in others or experiencing it ourselves.
You're listening to KBCast, the cybersecurity podcast for all executives. Cutting through the jargon and hype to understand the landscape where risk and technology meet. Now, here's your host, Carissa Breen.
Hey everyone, it's KB. Thank you for being an active listener on the show. And thanks to you, we've been downloaded in 63 countries. If you haven't already, please ensure that you follow and subscribe to the show for the latest updates. Now, time to get to the interview. Joining me today is Peter Bauer, CEO and co-founder of Mimecast. And today we're discussing the state of cybersecurity threat landscape from your perspective. So Peter, thank you so much for joining. I know you're traveling and you're out and about at the moment. You got a lot going on. So I really appreciate you making the time to talk with me today. So I want to start with a little bit more about you and your experience and what you're sort of seeing in your position, because you are an executive, you are looking across multiple different industries and multiple different organizations. So what worries you the most about cybercrime in the coming years? Now, I ask this because we've seen ChatGPT emerging, as well as AI and all these other things, but I really want to hear it from you and what you're seeing at a very high level.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Being a cybersecurity executive or responsible for a cybersecurity company that looks after over 40,000 organizations around the world and their most mission critical communication channel, email really, and all the millions of end users that sit behind those mailboxes and are potential allies to the cybersecurity program, but also could potentially be the weakest link in the chain. When you think about like where's the vulnerability and what could be coming down the track, I think mentioning ChatGPT and generative AI generally is a really interesting one, because I mean, these technologies are designed to improve productivity, and you have to think, well, what could they do to improve the productivity of adversaries? Now, in cybersecurity, one of the things we're very familiar with is the machine-generated attack, and the machine-generated attack that either focuses on machines, DDoS or directory harvesting, or machines that focus on attacking humans. So maybe credential harvesting or spam or, phishing attacks that are generated by kits. And maybe they might have some level of targeting. There could be a theme. And I think about, fires in Australia, and then there's sort of a scam to do with fundraising relief programs and so on. But they're quite generic. But if you think about what some of the most effective attacks are, they're generally kind of human-to-human attacks. So somebody does some research and they might know a few things about a target, maybe that they're on vacation somewhere, that they just started a new job in a particular company, that they, their kid goes to a certain school, or, they purchased a house, or in the process of purchasing a house, and they can glean this information through social media. And also there's a vast treasure chest of data available to adversaries thanks to numerous breaches that have occurred over. So that sort of human-to-human attack can be extremely effective, extremely targeting, and those deceptions work very well. Now, the mitigating factor has been that those are quite expensive to pull off, because there's somebody sitting behind a chair putting that thing together and figuring it out. And so they can't really be deployed at scale. Now enter ChatGPT and generative AI and think about what a technology like that could do to gather context and to create deceptive content at scale that can be used by a cybersecurity adversary to really operate at a much, much higher volume, to cast the net a lot wider with a much higher quality form of cyber attack. And what they could get in return in terms of the volume of credentials, the volume of funds, the volume of compromised individuals who might share information unwittingly. So it really is scary. And so from a defender's point of view, the technologies that we use to go and examine this content and interrogate communications, interrogate purported identities, just needs to keep getting smarter and being able to operate it at greater speed all the time to be able to deal with what, you know, potentially is coming down the track.
Okay, so there's a few things in there which is really interesting. You make a great point around ChatGPT, for example, around enhancement of productivity, which I get. But then there's the other side of it, which you sort of touch on, is the weaponization of ChatGPT, for example. So the thing that's been coming out recently, which is the part that I'm paying attention to as a security, you know, person in security from a media perspective, is ChatGPT to then write malware. So like back in the day, you had to somewhat be, you know, understand how to write malware. Now we're sort of saying, well, ChatGPT can write that for us. And as you sort of said, that can be then deployed at scale. So I'm curious to know from your perspective, Peter. So historically, cybersecurity people, and they still are, they're trying to get their head above the water. Now they're like, oh, okay, well, ChatGPT is just going to, you know, launch into the market, and now it's going to be able to write malware for us. And now it's going to be able to deploy malware, et cetera, at scale. So what does this sort of mean, though? Because, like, people were struggling before, and now we've just added in a big range of complexities, which are going to make it even harder. Like, I haven't really spoken to anyone on the show about it yet, so I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
To be fair, it's a concern, but to me it's less of a concern than the ability to perform what would have previously been a human-to-human attack. Because today we're quite good at dealing with machine-type attacks, malware-type attacks that are, you know, polymorphic, for example. So there's already malware that changes, so that we've moved on from being signature-based or hash-based alone to detect malware. We already use machine learning. We know how to examine files that have malicious content. We know how to do that pretty fast, pretty effectively, pretty reliably. It's not foolproof. But I'm not certain that it's as much of a game changer to have AI building malware, because the pathways still look like malware, and the pathways in are still vulnerabilities in systems and, you know, unpatched environments and so on. The human interface, though, the issue is that human-to-human attacks, they're deceptions. They don't look like human attacks. They look like legitimate mail, but they've changed something discrete about that mail that makes it fraudulent, that makes it inauthentic, that gives funds, information, credentials to the wrong person. And so it's a very, very different game, because when that lands up in front of somebody, if they fall for it, the consequences can be high. And then deploying the malware or getting whatever in beyond that is significantly easier, you know, whether that was generated by AI or in a more traditional way. So I worry about that. And, you know, it's a little bit, do you watch Antiques Roadshow?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, the plot there is, you know, people show up and they've got a thing that they found in the basement, and the expert examines it, and they, you know, they turn it over 17 different ways, and then they find this sort of marking, which is either there or it isn't there. Sort of, okay, so this is not an authentic, you know, Louis the 14th mouse pad or whatever they decide. So they've got an expert eye that's looking for very, very discrete signs and going through things that an untrained person wouldn't know to look for to determine authenticity and value. It's the same approach that we have to be able to apply at scale, examining communications coming at people. Is we've got to look for very, very discrete signs to be able to assess value, because you can't just stop communications. You have to allow enormous amount of communication to flow freely inside and outside of an organization. But you're looking for very, very discrete signs that will become more and more and more discrete, that indicate intent, that indicate authenticity, that compare with other things that we may have seen. So the sort of the expert capability in the system has to be there. And obviously the more valuable something is purporting to be, or the stronger the intent to acquire something is perceived to be, the higher the stakes are. And it's going to become, I think, a really, really interesting game of assisting human beings to make smarter calls about how they respond and participate to digital communications in a corporate environment.
Okay, so there's a few things I just want to press on there a little bit more, which was interesting. First of all, I like your analogy about Antique Roadshow. I have seen that. And occasionally people do win the jackpot when they think it was a piece of junk that they found. But beside that point, just going back to the scale side of things again, just so I get this right. So what you're saying is, you're not worried so much about ChatGPT from a scale perspective because most organizations at the moment have the environment to be able to deal with scale anyway. I mean, I used to be a practitioner in a bank. We would have thousands and thousands of things hitting us a day, right? And a lot of those were just automated because it's like, well, we can tell. So is that sort of what you're saying from that scalability perspective? Because people are set up to deal with it anyway. It's just going to be like, oh, what's 10,000 more?
What I mean is malware at scale. So being able to deal with malware and attacks that go after machines or vulnerability in machines, because those are easy to observe. Now, we benefit today that the ratio of good mail to mail that is not good, but is also human generated and highly targeted, that is designed to get through filters and designed to confuse or deceive a recipient in proportion. And so we have technologies that can detect those, but they're also expensive technologies to operate and run. And sometimes you're really reliant on training end users to spot things as well. Or we use intelligent bannering perhaps to provide an indicator to the recipient. Hey, do you know you've never replied? No one in your organization's ever replied or sent an email to this address. Do you know that the display name of this is very similar to somebody else you communicate with, but it's a different email address, or this domain was recently created? So there's color-coded, or certainly in the Mimecast implementation of this, color-coded advice that guides the user. Now, if you're in a world where you get, let's say, you know, I don't know, 1,000 emails and two of them are these types of things, well, that's one level of problem. But what if 100 of them were convincing pieces of content like this? What if an attacker, now it's 2 out of 1,000, I don't even know what the exact number is, but let's say it's 2 out of 1,000, because it's quite expensive for an attacker to create those. So they're going to choose targets very carefully, they're going to do their research, but they have to actually do work. There's a high cost. But if that cost drops by many orders of magnitude and computers can go do the research and go and comb social media, can comb dumps of personal data and can craft these things in a way and learn about what people are more susceptible to at the time, suddenly you're dealing with a much higher ratio of this type of content. I think that is going to change the level of threat that exists in environment if we're not able to answer that effectively with technology.
So then the other thing is as well, and maybe you know more about this, I'm just asking the question. I think from memory, people said, so with ChatGPT, if you're, I don't know, you're writing an article, but there's certain syntaxes that if you, I don't know, run some tool over it, for example, it'd be able to detect, obviously, that is, you know, AI-related content, just purely on like the syntax, how it's written. So then sort of that can then be applied from like an email perspective, potentially.
So go back to the antique roadshow thing. You start to know common traits of forgery artists. You know, well, back in 1960, there was this guy and he used to sort of use green paint from this thing.
Right.
And, you know, it wasn't the original. So it's like, it's that kind of mentality to say, okay, well, we now know this. Now, it's not, doesn't mean it's going to work all of the time, but it is, it's this level of expertise and knowledge that systems have to acquire and develop over time to say, that's an indicator of risk. If we're seeing, and it may not be conclusive, because there may be perfectly benign marketing emails that have been generated by GPT that are, you know, you may want to get. There may be expert content, you know, that's created by generative AI. You don't want to just convict everything because it comes from that environment. So you might need combinations of indicators. You might want to warn a user, this content appears to be created by generative AI. This also has not been used. You have no relationship with this person based on in an organization. There may be, you know, the IP address that this person sent from has been associated with malicious activity in the past. Like these are all indicators which either technology itself can say, well, you know, the risk is too high, we're going to block this, or you provide that context or that advice to the user so they can make a decision. You know, do they trust, do they act on this thing, or do they just hit delete? Or do they report it and say, no, I've looked at this too and I think it's problematic and I want to make our defensive machine smarter by referring this for further analysis, and here's my opinion because this thing's fishy.
So I want to switch gears now and focus on the executive side of things. So you yourself, you're an executive, so you understand how executives think. And as you know, CISOs have constant competing pressures and budgets, which have traditionally been stretched, and they're getting more stretched and stretched every year. And then, as you know, with the addition of the wave of the recent breaches here in Australia, would you be able to share some of your insights on how boards are responding to supporting all of this? Like, do you have any sort of insights to share with our audience today?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because, like, generally, I think we're all used to IT, certainly, and cybersecurity being considered somewhat of a cost center. And I've actually just come from a lunch today with a bunch of our customers and one of our great reseller and consulting partners in the region. And we had quite an interesting discussion. And towards the end of the lunch, I said, folks, I know you may not want to tell a vendor and a partner this and just pretend you've had more wine than you actually have, but how are budgets working nowadays? Have you felt a difference moving from, 21, 22, now to 23? The general macro environment, like what are CFOs saying to you? What's the environment like? And I was frankly expecting to hear a lot more stories of pressure on costs. And I'm sure I know in many areas of business that is true. But certainly in Australia, what I was hearing was in the wake of the Optus and, the other major breach on the medical provider
Medibank,
side,
yeah.
The feeling is from boards and from senior execs that might control purse strings but not be responsible for IT is, are we doing enough? Are we protected? Are we spending enough? Have we got the right tools? Are we in good shape such that we're not going to be somebody that's in the headlines? And I think it's cyclical. I think it sort of comes and it goes. People forget, the news cycle moves on. But certainly where we are right now, one of the benefits, it's cold comfort, frankly, but, of having a high profile breach is that it does create an impetus and awareness and a desire to invest in areas that are very important, but can be overlooked in the glory rush for perhaps other aspects of the business, investing or product development or applications that the business might want. Cybersecurity is so important. And, if boards go through periods of time and phases where they'll overemphasize it, let's grab that with both hands and move the ball forward, make the firm stronger.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by that comment that you've made with the people you're speaking with today, because there was something I was reading. PwC produced a report. They were saying that majority of like major companies in Australia, their CEOs are worried about cybersecurity. So now they're like, oh, okay, we've really got to look into it because of the breaches. Do you think it's just going to be like someone has to fall victim of the breach for people like pay attention? So what I mean by that is, so hypothetically, just say Medibank and Optus didn't have the breach. Do you think that if you were to ask the people at lunch today, they would have given you the same answer if the breaches didn't occur? Or, I know that you mentioned it before that it was the impetus, but do you think that someone has to lose in order for everyone else in the industry, and I don't want to use the word win, but to be like bring that awareness?
Yeah, I think unfortunately that is the case because, how do we assess risk? Like we can imagine risk, we can conceptualize it, but like how do we at the end of the day assess it? It's like it really impacted somebody else. Like if 10 people died of COVID, how would we conclude that we need to protect ourselves from it? But when you know that millions of people died from COVID, you kick into gear and you have a different action plan. So unfortunately, that is, I think how people quantify risk is what's the scale of the impact on others. Therefore, how many calories should I burn to avoid that fate myself? If it's remote, no. I mean, if you never met someone who's ever won the lottery, do you buy lottery tickets? I don't know. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. But if you've known 10 people that have won the lottery, my God, like
you'd be boring.
Yeah,
you'd be boring. Yeah. You'd be running out that door to get those lottery tickets.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay. So hypothetically, just say 20 more breaches happen in Australia. Hopefully that's not the case. Do you think that the budgets will just keep going up and up, similar to, people running out the door to get those lottery tickets? Do you think we will see that? Or what are you sort of, I know that's a hypothetical question, and I know that you don't have you're not Nostradamus, but I'm just genuinely curious.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the sad thing is probably during the time we've taken to record this discussion, they're probably 20 breaches. They're just not high profile. They're just more sort of incremental gainings of access or compromises that have happened in sort of corners of Australian businesses. Because this it's a constant activity of adversary action, and some of it goes undetected, some of it gets detected and resolved, remediated, stopped quickly. But 20 may be on the low end. But I think your question is like, at what point, like, is it diminishing returns to just keep throwing money at the problem? I don't know the answer to that. I do know that money isn't necessarily the only limiting factor. There are challenges around skills. There are challenges around the shift in new technologies being introduced that introduce new vulnerabilities, that there's some level of inevitability there, that there's increased exposure, and to what extent can more money and more cybersecurity tools mitigate that? Maybe the money has to be spent in building more secure technologies that we use. Maybe the money has to go into supply chains. Maybe it has to be, maybe we just have to avoid using certain types of technologies that expose us, if we can, expose us to risk. We dump an enormous amount of information about ourselves willingly across multiple social media platforms, the various forms of freedom of expression that we enjoy, security implications of those things. So the lack of budget can certainly cause problems. The lack of skill can certainly cause problems, or make it much more difficult to deal with problems. But the way the world is does set us up for some level of risk here. And so really examining what are the implications of our behaviors and our choices from a security perspective. Again, maybe it comes back to your prior question of, until enough people can see enough harm done to themselves as a consequence of things they've shared and exposed on social media, you know, maybe people will just not be as willing or interested in making a change. They don't see a need for that trade-off.
Yeah, and you're right. And just 20 high profile ones probably was what I was sort of more thinking of that you picked up on. So, and I think, like, before, and I mean, it's changed definitely over the years. Like, even when I was doing, like, executive reporting for a bank, like, we used to cover all these things to give that awareness, to be like, oh, you know, we obviously, and not from a FUD perspective, but more so like, hey, did you know that this was a thing? Like, you know, we had the Target breach, and then we had the Ashley Madison one. So, like, giving that awareness, but now it's 10x that. And then when it's in your own backyard, like a big player, like an Optus, who is, you know, owned by Singtel, $1 billion company, and they're getting breached, I think that's what started to sound the alarms for other people and ask those questions. But I really appreciate you sharing your insights on that. So as Mimecast is a global company, you have great insights. So I want to sort of understand, maybe from yourself, Peter, like, what are some of the current threat landscape that you're sort of seeing globally with your position, your customers that you talk to? Is there anything you can share?
We built a business on identity a lot around our work in email security, and that's super important. It's the number one attack vector. It's just a common culprit that shows up. It's such a useful tool in an adversary's kit bag. It's the pathway to the mind and the machine of every employee at the company. But that's really an intersection. The work surface is what adversaries are after. They're after this intersection of people, communications, and data. I don't think about that attack surface necessarily in categories like, you know, if you're familiar with Gartner, the magic quadrants or the boxes, the categories that a Gartner might think about. And, you know, this thing is going to defend endpoints, or this thing's going to defend mail, or this thing's going to defend networks, or like they see it, you know, an adversary sees it all as an environment that they need to penetrate. And they think in a, they inherently have a sort of a systems thinking approach to it. And so it's really important for us as defenders not to get too tied up in our boxes or our categories or our definitions, and more to think about adversary behavior and how do you stifle their ability to accomplish their outcomes. How do you follow their sequence of events and make sure that you have mitigations, detections, you know, ways to reverse them out at various of those points? And so a lot of our strategy and our branding, our positioning around this concept of work protected, which is kind of, you know, both the noun and the verb. You know, the work is protected, but you're able to work in a protected way, people, communications, and data, is really recognizing this kind of this global phenomenon. And emails is sort of right at the core of it, but there's a lot more to it around security awareness training, around dynamic policy based on individual risk, based on leveraging human beings. If they see something, say something so that you can kind of train machines to be better at detecting things in conjunction with humans. And then all of these detective technologies, the kind of things we spoke about, that we have to be good at looking at content and meaning, interrogating things, looking for unique forms of malware, blocking technologies, and then understanding if something gets in, what is the blast radius that thing is, who's got it, did anyone click on it, and how quickly can we get it out, and how do we share that intel, you know, through APIs with some of these other systems, like, you know, endpoint security, some of the other sort of Gartner Magic Quadrant sort of category products that our customers might have, so that defensive radius is expanded and made stronger a lot faster based on what we see coming at our customers through this, you know, this high intensity attack surface with email at the center of it.
So Peter, as you were talking, what was coming up in my mind was I was trying to understand, because you mentioned the lunch and, you know, the customers that you speak to and your executive yourself, so you get other executives. If you had to sort of like maybe name the top three sort of concerns from people that you're sort of speaking to in terms of cybersecurity, like, would you be able to illuminate like potentially like what they are? And again, there's no sort of right or wrong answer. It's just more so I'm just curious and just want to understand a bit of a barometer of where people are sort of at.
You know, a statement I've heard maybe too many times is a feeling from people that they might be tool rich but capability poor. Like they've bought a lot of things, but they haven't yet been able to turn this into a system. And part of that is a people and process. So they have technology, but the people and processes in place to make this all work together, to feel confident that it can be a reliable defense against creative attackers. I think that's a concern. So somehow finding a way to get to a system or a system of mesh, if you like, that's a concern. I think the second one is, you know, we're living in an environment with, you know, some would say, you know, globalization peaked and now we're in sort of geopolitical tension and rivalries. And some of that is sort of kinetic conflict and unfortunate. And some of it is digital. But we're clearly in a new phase of conflict and in nation states' willingness to go to the brink and to jettison relationships and alliances that would otherwise have been maybe a lot more productive. And so what does that mean for companies that are involved in these things? Governments can make all sorts of statements, but you know, the government doesn't administer my firewall, let alone buy it for me. They may be able to, you know, the FBI may be able to supply some intel or tip off about certain things, or they can arrest some culprit at an airport at some point in time. But like companies have to provide their own like digital armed forces in this regard. So people are concerned about that landscape. That's definitely a factor. And I think the third thing is it's the current economic environment and the skills in the market. It comes down to limited financial resource. So we're all competing. Companies are competing for cybersecurity talent. They've got a lot of complexity in the environment. They want the best talent, but they can't build out massive teams because there are economic pressures on them. And there is a limit to, you know, how many people have these skills and expertise. So there's a need to rely on service providers, on partners, and there's a growing sense that they don't know what they don't know. It's very, very difficult to hire and retain over a long period of time a top-class expert team of cyber folks in every organization that needs it. Of course, if you're, you know, a major government agency or a very large bank, you're going to find a way to afford these people, retain these people. But there's a massive mid-market of companies and who just frankly don't feel like they've got enough fingers to be able to stick in the dark and keep the thing secure. So That's a real concern.
Yeah, those are great. And I do agree with you on the geopolitical one, which is stuff I've spoken about on the show before, and I definitely believe it is a real concern. So in terms of any sort of final thoughts or closing comments, Peter, is there anything specific you'd like to leave our audience with today?
It's easy to think of the world today in static terms and to think that it is kind of going to be somewhat like it is on a perpetual basis. If we look at where we are today compared to where we were just 10 years ago, in terms of proliferation of mobile devices, in terms of new application architectures, I mean, even 10 years ago, something like the massive centralization of every company's thing like Office 365. I mean, in 10 short years, we've basically emptied our server rooms and moved all of our applications to a very, very small number of application providers. You know, if it's Microsoft and it's maybe AWS, like there's a massive centralization, consolidation, concentration. And there are great benefits to that. There's efficiencies and there's all kinds of cool new things that are possible. But it is worth just observing the shifting risk profile that brings with it. And thinking, you know, as people who are paid by our respective organizations to ask ourselves a question, what could possibly go wrong? Like, it's our jobs to think about that and to say, well, there's a lot of good involved. What could go wrong? And then think about mitigation strategies for that. And I'd encourage your listeners just to process that. It's no thing to do immediately, but just to bear that in mind as we continue this shift to massive centralization, concentration, dependency in core areas across all things. Everyone's eggs all in these baskets. In and of itself, it's not bad, but we've got to have mitigation strategies. We've got to be wide-eyed. We've got to educate our stakeholders as to the fact that potential risks can occur. And unfortunately, like we've discussed earlier on in our conversation, sometimes we only learn through the feeling of pain what the risk was, and then we respond to that pain, either observing it in others or experiencing it ourselves. I would just note that when you have this huge concentration and centralization, that the impact of that pain can be very, very widespread and can be felt very, very quickly. So it might be prudent to think about mitigations. And obviously that's a fair area of the work we do with, you know, tens of thousands of our organizations being on something like Office 365, providing layered security, risk mitigation capabilities, just to help them be more confident and secure while they embrace some of these new ways of consuming IT. So that would be my parting thought, Carissa. Thanks for spending time talking with me.
No, thanks for your time. And I will say that, yes, a lot has changed in the next 10 years. And who knows what's going to happen in the next 10 years? Maybe you'll have to come back on and, you know, do a where are they now for the next 10 years. Like, everything changes. Like, it perplexes me some days on how fast things just evolve and it grows. So I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, who knows? It's quite possible, Carissa, that a copy of this podcast will be featured on Antiques Roadshow in 10 years' time.
Maybe, yes, Antique Roadshow. Gosh, that makes me feel really old. Appreciate that, Peter. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on the show today, sharing your thoughts and your insights, and I hope you're enjoying your time down here in Australia.
Wonderful. Thanks, Carissa. Great to spend time with you.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope that you found today's episode useful and you took away a few key points. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get our latest episodes.
This podcast is brought to you by Mercsec, the specialists in security, search, and recruitment solutions. Visit mercsec.com to connect today.
If you'd like to find out how KBI can help grow your cyber business, then please head over to kbi.digital.
This podcast was brought to you by kbi.media, the voice of cyber.